Welcome to the Dungeon Plunger Podcast. My name is Jason Weeb, and this is the show in which I, a real-life janitor and dungeon master, teaches you how to plunge in and run a better Dungeons & Dragons game. Without further ado, let's plunge into this week's episode. Welcome, Dungeon Plunger Union members. I have my plus one plunger, a steaming hot cup of holy water, blessed by St. Keurig, and I have a very special union member with me today to help plunge the dungeon and flush evil down the drain. Welcome, Anthony, aka Runeslinger, to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. So, Anthony, tell us a little bit about who you are and what are you... What is your, you have a YouTube channel and you got a podcast, so let's just dive in. Tell us about yourself.
Okay, well, I've been playing role-playing games since 1983. I did not take a hiatus in the middle, so I've been continuously exploring. And then around 2010... I kind of recognized that big parts of RPG conversation were disappearing. You know, like older gamers were dying, or people were leaving the hobby altogether, or younger, I think of myself as younger gamers, were also disappearing from the hobby for various reasons. And so I started to blog and try to connect with people online. And to varying degrees of success over the years, and that meant branching out into YouTube and fooling around with podcasts and things like that. And so, you know, so here we are. There's a long record of my opinion of things to be found if you know where to look.
Yep. Do you have a preference as to like being a GM or a player?
Well, coming up, right from the very beginning, the second game I ever played, I was the game master. And so it was very normal in my understanding of a group that plays role-playing games together is that everybody plays and everybody runs the game. So really, I don't have a preference. So there are some games, though, that I have no interest in as a player, or that I have a lot of interest in as a player, and so I don't want to play the ones I don't want to play. I want to run them, and I don't want to run the ones I want to play if I can avoid it. So.
Do you have a preferred term for the person that runs the game? And, like, for example, like Game Master, Dungeon Master, Referee, Judge. I was talking to Matt Finch, and he was saying that kind of almost kind of characterizes the kind of person you are, depending on, or at least game, like the type of game master or person that you might be based on that category. I know you're a Call of Cthulhu player, so maybe Keeper.
I kind of like Keeper, the Keeper of Arcane Lore. That puts a nice spin on it. Game Master is the one I use when speaking publicly. Although I use GM more than Game Master. And I've met quite a few people in the last 10 years or so who interpret GM as Game Manager, which I find interesting. I tend and have always tended to react to the various names for that role with a little bit of humor. Like, what are they going to call it in this game? You know?
Yeah, it's true.
But I don't have a distinct preference.
Kind of riffing off of that, what do you feel like the role of the game master entails? I feel like there's so many different ways of sort of describing what that job entails or that role within the game. Where do you envision that?
I think pretty often the person who ends up running the game in the group is the person who has a particular game and a particular idea that they would like to try and, you know, bring into life, as it were, with their group. Like, I want to play this game with those people, and I have this idea for it in my head, so I guess I should run it. And that means that you're the first one maybe to make a pitch for the game. Like, I have this game and I'd like to do this with it. And then the group responds with yes, or yes and, or yes but, or no but. And we find what it is that we as a group want to do and who wants to be involved and who doesn't. I don't see the game master as the social coordinator. I don't see them as being responsible for everyone's fun. I see everybody in the group as being responsible for a good experience that we've agreed to. So that's a shared responsibility around the table. It doesn't fall on any particular person's shoulders more heavily than others. So the specific responsibility for the game master I see is knowing their role, what it is that they need to do with that group in that group's current condition with the game that they've chosen and the way that they've chosen to play it. What is it that I need to do? Do I need to have an encyclopedic knowledge of the rules this time? Are we going to share out understanding of the rules this time? Are we going for very immersive and engaging play? Are we going for a more relaxed, you know, system forward kind of play? You know, what's my part? How can I pull it off?
Yeah, that's a great way of describing it. I really like that. Especially this idea of like sharing the mastery of the rules, so to speak. The idea that like as the game master, it's not solely on you to know all the rules, that you can share like, hey, you know, I don't really know what the rule is. Can somebody look this up right now? Or somebody who has a better knowledge of the rule system to begin with, but you're just very enthusiastic. Like, I want to run this game, but I haven't had quite the time yet to master it. So I think that's fantastic. So how exactly did you get into the hobby? What was your origin story?
It's a pretty normal story, I think. This was during the Satanic Panic, of course. And some parts of this I've pieced together later, but I first heard about Dungeons & Dragons from my uncle, who wanted to explain this game to me because he thought I would like it. And my father walked in on this conversation of his brother and his son and ended the conversation. And I didn't know why it wasn't explained to me. And then a couple of years later, one of my good friends, we were talking about books that we liked, and he said, well, you're going to love, you know, D&D. And I didn't really know what it was, and I said, sure. So he ran a session, and he gave me my own copy of Basic. Said, this is your copy. I don't need it anymore, and you'll run the next game. I said, sure. And it has been going on since then. Since March of 1983, so I've just passed another anniversary.
Nice. That's pretty awesome. Yeah, I was watching a video recently. I don't know if it was like an AI thing, because now it's kind of sketchy with some of this stuff, but it was kind of talking about the Satanic Panic and all these, like, if you play D&D, it talks about cannibalism, Satanism, and all this other, like, slavery, and it just went on and on. There was like this massive list. I sent it to my group, and they all laughed, and they were like, dude, you're a bad dungeon master, because we haven't learned any of these things. So, and my sister, who has a master's in theology, was telling me, or religious studies, she was saying about how a lot of that stuff is like covered in the Bible. And so I thought that was pretty funny, right? That there's more of that going on in a religious text than a role playing game.
There's a lot of racy stuff there. Yeah. The way it was explained to me later, I had a conversation about it with my parents when I was an adult, and my father's big concern was how it encouraged kind of unbridled imagination in people who didn't have a firm grounding in who they were as people yet, and that might encourage experimentation in other areas, which might get them into some trouble. But quite honestly, I think that the actual reason was that it was something you didn't want people to know that your kid did.
Right? Yeah.
You should stand up against the social pressure of it. So they apologized to me many, many years later. And we had real talks about it. And, you know, they're involved in gaming now. So I consider that a minor victory.
Seriously.
But
wow, that's
fantastic. It was a hard couple of years of having to hide what I recognized was a really vital activity with my friends that, you know, otherwise I just would have probably not had friends at all.
Really. Okay.
I would have had acquaintances at school, but I developed friendships that I still have, you know.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty heavy when you think about it. So how does that, when you see how open and accepting people are about D&D and a lot of the like nerd tropes like comics and all that kind of stuff today, how does that make you feel? Is there a certain amount of resentment where you're like, why couldn't I have grown up in an era where there was this sort of like acceptance of this stuff? Or do you feel more of a sense of like, yeah, man, like finally we're getting our due?
I've never really cared much about what society at large thought. And so my father, for all his resistance to D&D, read fantasy novels. He read a lot of science fiction. We had a big love of Star Wars and Star Trek. You know, so I was surrounded by stuff that I was interested in. Could talk about it with my family, could talk about it with my gamer friends. And I didn't feel a lack, and I didn't feel judged. I felt that if shade came my way, that was more a commentary on the person who didn't understand what I liked and not a commentary on me at all. So I'm happy that that more people are getting into interesting things. I'm a little worried that we're not really it's just that there's more channels, there's more venues to get more IP in front of eyeballs to move advertising, I feel, is really what we're seeing, rather than a real widespread embracing of, you know, so-called nerd culture or whatever. And it's become more accessible or more acceptable for older people to entertain themselves. So the market isn't just that slice of, you know, 12 to 20 something people anymore who can mass consume media like comics and movies. It's now, you know, everybody can keep up with their hobbies and it's okay.
Yeah, I hadn't really considered that, especially as adults, right? Like, we're the ones that have the money to be able to consume, so therefore we would be the perfect market. So recently, talking about your concerns and stuff like that, recently you were on Roleplay Rescue with Che, and you were talking about, if I'm not mistaken, how you have a concern that role-playing games are being marketed or at least explained more along the lines as storytelling games. Was that accurate?
That's accurate. I mean, you know, what we were talking about in that episode, and I hope people will, you know, seek it out and go listen. We're talking about how the view of what role-playing games can encompass has kind of narrowed down to a specific focus where if you ask somebody what it is, that phrase storytelling is bound to crop up. Right. It's collaborative storytelling. It's a storytelling activity. It's about stories. You can be in a story. You can take part in a story. You know, you can't seem to escape from that word, where that's only a part of what you could be doing.
So what exactly is it, though, that concerns you in that sense? Like, one of the things that I took away from that conversation that I found really fascinating, because I guess I've always looked at role playing as a story game for however there's like levels, right? So for instance, like White Wolf with, you know, Vampire the Masquerade and stuff like that, you know, that was sold as the storytelling system, right? So it was really had a heavy focus on tellings, or at least making stories and talking about how, I guess like the way books and movies do it. And so using those as really heavy analogies of like how you should run these games, right? Whereas something maybe like, because I really started my gaming career with D&D 3rd edition. So to me, you know, when we played, there was a heavy tactical element to it, but I always felt like we were, through the course of play, telling the story of our characters. And
telling it or discovering it?
Yeah, you're right. We were probably discovering it, but I just assumed that the easiest way to say it was we're telling a story. Right. So that was why when you were saying, oh, I'm concerned about it being a storytelling, like we're selling this as a storytelling game, I was like, and then you were saying, well, we're telling a story afterwards. Right. Like when we talk about it afterwards, that's when the story is really coming out. And I was like, oh, wow, I'd never really considered it in that way. So I found it a very, very interesting discussion that you guys had. But yeah, it was more of like, let's say that's the case, that this is more being pushed more as a storytelling sort of thing. What exactly is it that you feel we're losing from that?
Well, I believe that, you know, what contracts or narrows down in focus will eventually become so focused that it will create its own dissatisfaction, and then people will invent, reinvent, or rediscover or whatever what has, you know, technically been lost or obscured from them. So I'm not worried about it disappearing forever. But what I am worried about is that me personally, had I started gaming this year, and the games I'm likely to have encountered that my buddy would hand to me, I would not have been interested in.
Mm.
And from my perspective, you know, I'm now over 40 years as a role-playing gamer. No other interest or hobby or anything like that has stuck with me as long, or has sparked the kind of conversations I've had, the kind of friendships I've had, the kind of relationships I've had, than this particular one. And I wouldn't even start it if this is the activity as presented. It doesn't appeal. And I can't be the only one.
Yeah, no, I'm sure that's really, no, I feel like that's really profound. I like that idea. So, and I do feel like it's a lot more clear to me. I had wanted to call in and, you know, discuss it on, you know, Che's show and get some more feedback from you. But I was like, oh, you're going to be on my show. So I figured it would be the perfect opportunity. And, you know, so one of the ways that I really kind of found you was through Call of Cthulhu. And so part of it was because I was looking, well, I'd heard you on Roleplay Rescue before and stuff. And it wasn't until when I was really looking for Masked and Nyarlathotep stuff for, you know, prepping my campaign, where I was like, oh, wow, this dude's got like, it was almost like at the same time as I was doing this, that you put out that video of talking about masks. And
the arcane,
yeah,
and the armchair keepers of arcane secrets.
Yeah. And so I was like, oh, sweet. So I watched that, and then I started watching a bunch of your other Call of Cthulhu stuff. And then you did your big recap on the campaign that you're running. And so I was like, wow, man, Anthony sounds like he's got a really interesting perspective on Call of Cthulhu, and he sounds like he's got a lot of experience, and just this campaign you're running sounds fantastic. So I was like, we got to talk about that. So tell me, where did you get your start at Call of Cthulhu?
My first 7 or 8 years gaming, I had no game store. And so everything that I got was either hand-me-down or like secondhand kind of thing. It was all D&D. And when I went to university, my family also moved to Halifax from a small town. And so, now I have access to game stores. And my first foray in, it was at an old location of a place that was called Odyssey 2000, which doesn't exist anymore. But they had a rack that you would, like, you open the door to go in, and this rack is right behind the door. You're hitting it, you know, at the door. So then you have to awkwardly close the door to get in. The place was just jam-packed with stuff. And that's where I saw Palladium Fantasy First Edition for the first time, and I saw Call of Cthulhu there for the first time. There's lots of other stuff that was in that rack, but those were the two games that I ended up buying before going back to school. And I read them both, and we were transitioning away from D&D. And so what are we going to play next, kind of thing. Everybody had a bunch of games they wanted to play. One guy wanted us to play Champions, and we were about to get West End Games Star Wars, but we didn't know it yet, and this kind of stuff. So what are we going to play? And we ended up playing Palladium Fantasy, but I kept reading Call of Cthulhu. And I liked the system. The system made total sense to me instantly. And I felt like the dissatisfaction I felt as a dungeon master would probably disappear in this game, that my preferences in that role would better fit cosmic horror than they would the dungeon delving, you know, exploration stuff. My instincts tend to take me into darker, more punishing places. I didn't really like a combat focus in games anyway, and I liked combat to have a different feel. And all of these questions were being answered by reading basic role-playing. And this was the fourth edition of Call of Cthulhu. So it was a very compact set of really all of the rules that you would need to run it without any other support, which was good for me because I didn't have any money and there was not going to be any further support coming. Whereas looking at Palladium Fantasy, I could already see that there was this long growing list of regional source books and whatnot. Would I need them? Did they have rules that I wanted in them? And you know, that was not terribly appealing. So after a little while playing Palladium Fantasy, I said, let's do Call of Cthulhu. First sessions were a big hit. They bought me massive Nyarlathotep, so I felt obligated to run it. And as soon as I read it, I was like, this is incredible. I don't know if I can run this, but I'm going to try. And it was a big success. We're still talking about that, those sessions, you know, decades later. So that is what hooked me on Call of Cthulhu, that I found my voice as a game master in that game. I found confidence as a game master with that system and with those people. And it's kind of like the gift that keeps on giving.
Right. I feel like that's such a key point that you just made, that if we want to be good game masters, we need to have the confidence in ourselves to, like, get behind that game that we're running. And I think that once you allow, you know, your fear to be under control, and you say, okay, you know what, like, I know why, maybe I'm not doing this right, but that's cool. We're like, it's literally a game changer, I feel. So one of the things that I noticed, because I definitely want to delve into the Masked Nyarlathotep part, but I just wanted, so with masks, it has a different feel from the, like, Lovecraftian cosmic horror aspect, and it feels like a very pulp adventure style campaign, almost like an Indiana Jones feel.
You're reading the seventh edition version, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's always had that pulpy feel.
Yeah. So, but it almost feels like it's counter to what the rules, or what the way the game was presented, and sort of the deadliness that comes from the game. So how did you how did you rationalize that yourself?
By the time I had Mass, we hadn't had many combats. I had a sense, but I'm not a math guy. I'm not going to work it out mathematically, like the likelihood of, you know, what's the average damage of an attack going to be versus the average number of hit points. That's not how I approached it. I ran different combats, you know, for fun, and we did combat trials and stuff, as you do when you're learning a new system for fun. And it seemed much more lethal than what we were prepared for. And the group kind of rose to the challenge as a challenge. But the game is talking, because I'm reading it as the intended keeper, it tells you, you know, that if you get into combat, you've already made a mistake. And I thought that was interesting. I think that would have made more sense to me way back then had I already been into RuneQuest or other BRP games. But this was my first exposure to that particular idea, that if you get into combat, you've made a mistake, because this is not reflected in Star Wars, which we had played a lot of by this point. It was not reflected in Top Secret, which we'd played a lot by this point. It's not reflected really in any other game that we had experienced, just this one. And I liked what it was telling me, that, you know, if the group walked into combat, then I could just drop the hammer on them, and that would be appropriate. And that would, you know, psychologically speaking, change how we played with the next set of investigators. Right. So I didn't know how deadly it was, but looking at how long Masks of Nyarlathotep seemed to be, I thought the only reasonable way to approach it would be really as an organization. The players needed to have multiple characters, and they needed to have characters who had a reason to not be traveling with the group. It might be following along behind, or it might be running along, you know, beforehand to book hotels or whatever, right? And so that's kind of how it was approached. And then the cleverness of the different playgroups that I've played with have enabled them to get pretty far. I've never had a group who's managed to go through all of the chapters as one cohesive unit, and which encouraged me the last time I ran it to start groups in all of the main locations and get them going, and then have an alternate group that was trying to go through it in order.
That's really interesting. So, okay, tell me a little bit more about that. So you had a main group, and then they had like spare characters that were in each of the major locations, or was it you actually had groups playing simultaneously in the
different groups of players, separate from each other?
Okay, interesting. And this was all happening like at the same time you were running it for multiple groups all at, wow, that, how did you manage to keep that organized? That must have been a real challenge.
I don't know. I mean it's similar to what we're doing now with the Turn of a New Leaf campaign that's appearing in bits and pieces as an actual play on the channel, where we have five independent groups. Sometimes they merge and cross over, and sometimes they don't. I try to keep everything, like when play is happening regularly every week, it's mainly in my memory, but I'll take notes of things that need to track over time, like when were different groups in different places, and if someone has to sail from Shanghai to Australia, for example, that's going to take a certain amount of time. So, you know, when will they arrive? And you mark that on the calendar, because that's a detail. It's easy to forget, and it's possible to get period calendars for the year that you're using, so you can know what day of the week it is and that kind of stuff. So I track it that way. But it was a little difficult to juggle all of the props.
Yeah.
And so I used manila folders and luck.
Yeah. Did you have the H.P. Lovecraft box at that time, or were you using?
Well, this is all before that. So I haven't gotten a chance to use that yet. It's still sitting, taunting me, much like yours is back there. Yeah.
I'm really, really hoping to get to use that. And I'm hoping that the, that it's worth it, that the players really, feel that it's helping them be more immersed and more engaged. But time will tell. So I do want it to get into the, you call it the leaf turns. How do you describe
it? Turn of a new leaf.
Turn of the new leaf, right. So I do want to get into that because I think that's super fascinating. But I just wanted to step back for a minute where you were talking about how you got your start with 4th edition Call of Cthulhu. And so because it's your first, is that your preferred edition of the game?
I like the mood of it, and I tend to run Call of Cthulhu in the 20s and 30s. And that's the last edition that was set only in the 20s, right? When 5th edition came out, there are rules, you know, not so much rules, but it had Gaslight and the 20s and the 90s all in one set of covers, and that continued in the different editions of 5 and the different editions of 6. And I like the art in it. I've memorized the organization of it, so it has an ease of use that way. What's interesting about the early editions of Call of Cthulhu is that we have first edition, which gets expanded with like companion volumes and this sort of stuff. And then when second edition comes along, all of the stuff is still 100% compatible. And then third edition, we start to see them being packaged together. Like there's a famous hardcover version of third edition that was done by Games Design Workshop, I think licensed through them. And so it has, you know, the Cthulhu companions in there. So you, under one set of covers, you had a gazetteer for the 20s, and you had the BRP rules, and you had stuff about insanity and psychoanalysis and crime and all the stuff all together in one set. Fourth edition just kind of made that all prettier, and then fifth edition made it easier to use, and then sixth edition made it even easier to use. So I'm using 6th edition for the campaign we're running on the YouTube channel now, because that's what the players had. And you know, I really enjoy using it. It will probably be my go-to edition moving forward rather than 4th. But if you ask me which one my favorite is, it's 4th.
Do you have any sort of like a reticence to using 7th, or is it just because rules wise, I don't really think a lot has changed from like 1st to 6th, right? Like I think there was like they added or took away skills. Yeah,
really minor changes.
I find that really fascinating how this game has endured for so long with almost no changes to it until 7th edition. And
that speaks to the strength of the system. So just as an example, in Che's group in the campaign, we're using the 2nd edition rules. I don't have to make any changes.
That's the box set?
Yeah, the up there next to Twilight 2000 4th edition there on your bookshelf. So, it's that easy to mix and match. So I don't use published scenarios as a general rule. So I'm not bothered by the conversion effort created by 7th edition, where you do have to make changes to character stats and this sort of thing. That doesn't particularly bother me. I would recommend 7th edition to anyone thinking about getting into Call of Cthulhu. Everything has more support. It's all readily available. And some really cool and interesting people are working for Chaosium. But the changes that were made are changes that get in the way of how I play it. And many of them are considered to be optional rules, which I wouldn't take the option to use. So it just doesn't make any sense. So as you take them away, you're basically left with 6th edition with some procedural changes which add more work and claim that they don't. So there's a lot of streamlining that actually makes chases longer, which makes things like automatic weapons fire more difficult than it used to be. And it's just, it's not worth the effort to me. But if that's your first exposure to Call of Cthulhu, then there is no conflict. There's no, well, it was this rule was better before, or this is a better version, and you don't have that disconnect or that negative feedback. Just, you know, take these beautifully printed, you know, games and run with them and have fun. And they are pretty easy to convert back, so you can use all the old material with just a little bit of work. So no reason not to use Zenith.
I noticed that Masks has like the potential for a lot of chase scenes. And so to me, I find it interesting you bring up the chase scene mechanics from 6. Do you feel like those like work better? Like, would you recommend that I use those, like 6th edition instead of using the 7th edition rules?
The 7th edition, the way it's written, is going to play into how those 7th edition chase rules are written. As a procedure, yes, chases were easier before, but all of the drama of the chase was left fully on your improvisational shoulders. All the old system measured was the relative distances between the chaser and the chased. So building tension and why the gap is closing or opening is entirely left on your shoulders and the players if they were involved in describing anything, you know, in your culture of play. So there are advantages to the way 7th edition does it. But, you know, after all these years, I've built those muscles. And so it's just, I would prefer to have a less intrusive mechanism that I've already internalized to use than to follow the step-by-step procedure of the new way and relearn it to get the same benefit.
So did you develop a bunch of house rules and stuff for your game based off of like the years of experience, or you're pretty much straight from the book?
Yeah. I mean, we used to house rule D&D all the time. And, but once we started to experiment, it just has never really come up again. So we played the game, we either liked the game or we didn't. If we didn't like it, we stopped playing it. And, but when D&D was the only game we had, to get satisfaction out of it, we had to, you know, mess with it. And, you know, cause we loved it and we loved playing it and we loved the characters that we were playing, but there were parts of the system that we were either using wrong or, you know, that we could see there was a different way to do it and we wanted to experiment, you know, or we were trying to do things that weren't really represented and, you know, pushing it into different IPs and the like. But I tend to run games as well as I can the way that they are written. And after a period of time, if some part of a game is bugging me and it's bugging the other players, then we'll talk about it. Like, do we want to change games? Do we want to change this rule or whatever it is that's bothering us? Or you know, what is it that we want to do? And usually it's just, you know, we'll play a different game if it really bothers us, or we'll try to understand it better if it doesn't.
Tell me about this campaign that you're running right now, because this sounds like super fascinating. You have five, is it that right? Five branches that are going on?
Five independent.
Yeah. So talk about how you started this and how things have sort of progressed.
Well, it started as a longtime friend of the channel, Ivan Mike, 1968, had received a copy of the 6th edition of the Call of Cthulhu rules and recognized that while we had done many Call of Cthulhu things together, like using Ubiquity for Leagues of Adventure or other situations, other games, we hadn't ever played the original together. We hadn't played Call of Cthulhu together. So what's that like? So I said, okay, I'll run it for you and we'll do it solo, but let's leave the door open for other people to join. So we made a character who was a reporter, and we thought it'd be really kind of interesting if, as a reporter, he might have lots of contacts, you know, and things around the city. And what made that even more interesting is that the character he created isn't terribly likable. So it kind of set up this kind of confrontational relationship with all these people that he knows in all these different parts of the city. And from the very first session, we had a real good response to it. We enjoyed what we were playing. And so we started to recruit right away. And so his character would call or go visit these people, and these players would join as those characters as play went on. And then that made a nice solid route. I had a pretty strong imagination of what this fictional version of Boston was like, and the way that these original three players were doing their investigation was pretty interesting. And so I just was asking around people that I knew that I hadn't played with before, you know, are you interested in joining this campaign? And yes. And so I started them off as solo investigators as well. And they have had the opportunity to recruit people if possible and that sort of stuff. And play has only gone about 6 weeks in the almost 2 years that we've been playing.
Wow.
And that we play for, you know, 90 minutes to 2 hour sessions at the, during the first year, there was three or four sessions run per week. And that's slowed down because my schedule has gotten in the way over this last couple of months. But the different independent groups have had opportunities to cross over. They've been in the same places within hours of each other, but didn't meet, or they have met, and all kinds of interesting stuff is happening. And in the actual play series, we are now within, I can't remember if it's two or three episodes I need to release before the first major crossover where every player but one is in a scene together.
Wow. So how many players would that be?
That was seven people.
Wow. That's a big group.
Yeah.
Was that challenging to run?
One of the precepts for the game was that it was going to be as immersive and as engaging as possible, given the restraints of it being, you know, through Zoom. But when I have to switch scenes between people or present information from the perspective of your character alone, that requires a different form of attention than normal. If we're playing solo, everything I tell you is the voice of your senses or the influence of whatever insanity is bubbling up inside your character, or what another character is actually saying to you, or it's a description. And not a lot of switching of attention has to take place. But if you recognize someone who comes through the door, but someone else doesn't recognize the person who comes through the door, one of those two people either has to, quote, leave the room or ignore what I'm, you know, the extra information. And so the play experience changed. But as for making it harder to run, no, it wasn't harder to run, but it completely changed the play experience. So the trade-off was, do we enjoy playing together enough for that trade-off to be worthwhile? And, you know, it was. So there were more crossovers as we went on. They sought each other out more often.
So the campaign takes place in Boston. How much research did you have to do, and what resources did you use, if any, for the setting?
It grew over time. My natural inclination is, if a game is going well, then I want to think about it more. And my preparation style is focused very much on the NPCs. And like if you look over old campaign notes and whatnot that I have, when I write out about an NPC, I'll have, like, how do they sit in a chair? How do they order their coffee? What do they do in a cafeteria? I have these kinds of notes about them, like they're the very mundane aspects of their characters. So in the beginning, Ivan and I weren't sure how long we would want to play. Like, would we do one investigation, whatever that is, and then be done? Then I wouldn't really need to know much more about Boston than I already do as someone who grew up on the East Coast. Right? I've been there. He's been there. You know, we've seen lots of movies to fill us with an idea of what it looks like and what it sounds like. We've both been to the, you know, the Atlantic coast many times. So we know what it smells like, all these things to make it real. It could be real enough with just that. But as it took root, as it became successful, more people were getting involved in it. Then I wanted to know things like street names. I wanted to know the actual, like, how long does it take to walk from Boston Commons down to the docks? You know, is that something that you would reasonably want to do, or would you call a cab? I wanted to have a better sense of that. And so that research was how I occupied myself as the weeks, you know, went on. And I started sharing maps as like background on the screen, and they're pop-ups, like when they travel from one side of the city to the other, there's a pop-up that with, you know, the little red line that goes across to, this is their route of travel. These are things that they don't see when they're playing, but if they choose to go back and watch the actual play video, they can see.
Neat. So do you use like Google Maps to sort of get a rough idea of like how long it would take to walk somewhere, or do you like map it out some other way?
I use period maps because it's set in 1931, and it's kind of interesting how much the physical region of Boston has changed, like how much land has been created in that city since people started to live there.
Interesting.
So the way that the streets work really makes sense if you, like, you wind back through all these different period maps to see how much water used to be where city is now. And so that started to play its own role. So I use these period maps, and I use their relative scale. And I'm not that concerned about being perfect. It's a fictionalized Boston. I want to leave enough room for the imagination of the players to be able to make the setting real to them. So, like an example, in an early session, we knew what street we were on. We hadn't really described what would be seen out the window, but the player whose apartment they were in was prepared to talk about what was outside that window. He knew that there was a bakery out there, and you know what kind of relationship he had with the bakers. It was all set. It was all part of his understanding of who his character was. So I want that kind of freedom. I don't want someone to stop play and say, you know, excuse me, you know, keeper of arcane lore, but what does my character know about their own neighborhood? I didn't want to have that be a part of the experience. So I'll contribute things that need to be there, like it's difficult to find where a particular newspaper office would have been in 1931. You know that it was active and publishing there, but where actually were its printing presses? And so at a certain point, if it's relevant, you have to put it somewhere in play. So you put it somewhere, and that's where it is.
One of the things that you had mentioned is that you don't really use published scenarios. But as I was listening to your big recap, I couldn't help but hear certain things that I was like, ooh, that comes from a scenario. That comes from a scenario. So how much of the stuff is stuff that you created yourself, and how much of it came from? I don't know if you want to talk about this because you don't want to reveal secrets.
I don't think there's any spoilers. And there's like, even if the players were to go out and read the scenarios I've referenced, I don't think there's anything to spoil. But I chose purposefully to set it in 1931 so that a lot of Chaosium scenarios are in the past. And so then it's fun for me to say, what would have happened to to this particular region. There's not that many that are set in Boston. There's a few that are quite interesting. And, you know, one of them that I've referenced, it's been put up in the annotations on the actual play videos that, that gets referenced a lot as Shadows of Yog-Sothoth. And so it starts out in Boston. And so there's a kind of a Masonic kind of fraternal organization, occult organization that's referenced as part of that particular scenario. So I pay homage to that, that very fun scenario by including it, but from the perspective of 1931. And so some of the surviving NPCs are still in the setting, but they're all reinterpreted as for a different universe. And there's also some very unusual links to Masks of Nyarlathotep in there. There's a family whose last name should definitely be recognized to anybody who's played the London chapter of Masks. And they might be wondering, why is this character name, why is this family in use in, you know, in this weird campaign by, you know, a turn of a new leaf? Why is it in there? And maybe that will come out and maybe it won't. Who knows? But it's just entertaining for me.
So do you have any kind of inspirations that you use, like books or movies that were really inspirational to you as you were building the campaign?
No. The campaign springs from an unusual situation, which is the opening situation of play. And so I thought, okay, this is the situation I'm going to describe first for our reporter. He's going to stumble into this crime scene, let's say, this very unusual crime scene. And the reporter is there's no way that he'll be able to say to himself, what I have seen in this crime scene is natural. So, you know, it's a very unnatural death. And if he actually investigates the room in which it happens, he'll find some other things which are very obviously unnatural and are doing things that that normal objects cannot do. So that was the start. So then I get to rewind a little bit in my imagination and say, how could that scene have come about? Right? Why would our possible murder victim be in the office of this infamous private detective? Why is he there? So once I knew why he was there, then I had a way to look at NPCs that were needed, right? People that would be supporting this potentially dead murder victim and people that were, you know, giving him grief. And that's all I needed. That's all I needed for that first one. Right. And then in between, I just keep imagining, I keep trying to get in the heads of this small cast of NPCs that I invented for that first scenario. So they're in this Boston, this fictionalized Boston. We're in striking range of the Lovecraft story Pickman's model, which means Pickman's running around. And the Boston that's described in that story can influence how I describe things. You know, that part of town that people don't want to go to. Well, where is that exactly and what happens there? And I've got the Depression to draw on. So the streets are easy to describe because of the social unrest, the people looking for work, the soup lines, the street urchins, the whole nine yards. And then it just becomes a matter of, you know, we play. And so I write into the calendar what the characters actually did and where they were when they did it. And then using the system, I roll dice. And what did the NPCs accomplish or fail to accomplish in whatever their goal was? And the characters are free to move around anywhere in Boston that makes sense to them. And what they encounter, they encounter. What they make sense of, they make sense of.
Do you feel like there was anything in your professional or perhaps maybe like your RPG background that's stuck with you to make you a better game master? Something that you're like, wow, this was really, kind of formational in how I approach the game?
Maybe the other way around. I think maybe the types of games that I ran, kind of predisposed me to thinking about people. So I spent a lot of time working in human resources and management and skill training and this sort of thing. And I tend to think about, who is this person sitting before me? What are they trying to do? How can I help them do it? And in a nutshell, that's really how I see gaming. Also, we've got this three-part rule that we like to follow. A friend of ours called it the Holy Trinity, but it's talk with the players. All right, you want to play a game? Okay, the first thing you have to do is talk with the other players. Then, after that talk, when you get all the information, you have to play the right game to satisfy what's been discussed with the players. And then, if problems start to arise, as satisfaction starts to dwindle, you got to be a part of the solution. And then rinse and repeat. Right? Talk with the players, play the right game, be part of the solution. And so I think all of that kind of is a recurring feedback loop.
So I think if I could take away something from what we've talked about today, is that really your NPCs, more than anything, are the core of telling. Where I don't want to say telling your story because we've already covered that, but
and there it
but,
is, right?
But they're at the core of making the game come alive. Understanding those NPCs' motivations, understanding, what they want, kind of their little quirks that make them unique and kind of memorable to the players,
and not giving them an agenda, right? Like an agenda in the terms of like a planned out thing, like. By December, they will have done this. I have to actually, in order to satisfy my own play, I need to discover if the next step in their plan functions as intended. And if it goes awry, how does it go awry? And what do they have to do to compensate? And
would I be correct in saying that kind of your game prep for the next session would be sort of asking yourself those questions? Okay, so what are the NPC's next steps? How do I see what the players are going to do next and how those might interact with these NPCs?
Except I don't think about the players at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If they tell me that they're going to go to the local mental hospital and there's no reason to believe that they won't, then I will, of course, spend time imagining the local mental hospital. I'll make sure I have a receptionist for them to talk to that's different from the hotel receptionist, that's different from the waitress, or at least I hope they seem different. And what's the mood of the place? Like, what's going to be the takeaway piece of description from that? I hope I can find it when I try to imagine what that place is like and that sort of stuff. But if it's business as usual, if they're going to be continuing to investigate in a location that we described last time, then I don't really need to consider what their plans are. I do need to know what the other characters within my control are doing, because they do nothing if I don't do something with them. And then the world feels kind of empty, like nothing's moving and nothing's happening. So sometimes I need to think about the newspapers, like what kind of newspaper clipping might be on the front page. What are the boys, extra, yelling on the street corner. And then I'll make like a little audio file of that and stick it into the video or send it to the players, that kind of stuff. And if they don't listen to the radio, then I don't have to share that stuff. And if they don't read the newspaper, then I don't have to share that stuff.
So would you be giving just like a sense of like the world around them, or would there be actual sort of like clues or possible sidetracks or like, you know, new scenario seeds that you give out in those? Like what's the sort of agenda with that?
I want the world to feel reasonably alive. Like, I want them not to feel like the streets are empty except for their car. I want them to feel like there's traffic and there's stuff going on. And then if they stop and they talk to the guy selling chestnuts next to the trolley, you know, entrance, that he might have something to say. He might have heard something, seen something, or whatever. What they make of it is on them. So I don't see it as supplying a list of rumors in the tavern that lead to adventure sites. The people that they meet are going to give them a view of Boston, and something is going to be relevant or not relevant depending on luck, in a sense, and their own planning. There is a luck score in Call of Cthulhu 6th edition, and I'm using it mainly to cover questions that I think should not be my decision to make. Like, it's a Thursday, and this character and this character are going to the same place, and it's in the morning, right? I can use the luck roll to see if they encounter each other.
Right.
And, you know, how things play out that way. There are clues, yes, based on, let's say, failures to commit terrible acts. And so clues are left behind. No, you know, no crime is perfect. So there's that sort of stuff. And many of the more villainous characters are very flawed people. And they might want people to know that it was them that did a thing. So it's possible for, you know, information to get back to these characters and that sort of thing. But in terms of a set route of, you know, this clue and this house leads to this clue and that house, which leads to a therapist file, which leads to a mistress who then spills the beans about what's really going on, and then there's none of that. There's no story plotting out what's forward. There was an inciting incident around a MacGuffin, which has then sparked, you know, 2 years of play, and for all these different groups of people.
So that kind of makes me wonder, when you're talking about clues and stuff like that. So one of the things that I've noticed in the Call of Cthulhu community is that you have a lot of keepers who are extremely big on crafting newspaper articles and clues and all these like tangible things that they can give to their players. And this seems to be a very big part of the community.
Yeah.
Is that something that you do beforehand? Because my sort of experience running mysteries, and I wouldn't be consider myself to be a pro in any way, but I've very much been in the mind of like, look, the clue needs to be wherever the clue needs to be, because if the players can't get access to that core clue, then they're sort of screwed. I don't know if you feel similar to that, but And it might not necessarily be the same kind of clue. Like, it wouldn't necessarily, like, it doesn't make sense that there would be a newspaper article stuck in a guy's pocket if, you know, for instance, it maybe, you know, if we're playing in a modern time, you know, he had a voice memo or, you know, a message from somebody on his phone or, you know, so depending on the circumstances, I'll sculpt the clue to sort of fit like where it makes sense. Where do you stand on that? And is that sort of how you approach it when you're giving out the that kind of stuff?
When I first got into Call of Cthulhu, one of the things that was really exciting for me were the different handouts that were available. But like I said before, I just don't run these adventures. I ran Mass of Narlathotep because it was a gift. I've read Shadows of Yogg-Sothoth like four or five times. I've never run it, but I've used pieces of it. I've used NPCs from it and whatnot in the background of other things in case I ever felt motivated to run it. It would be primed. Like the prime issue with Jackson Elias and Mass of Narlathotep, can't run Mass unless the characters already care about him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't feel satisfied if I just say, hey, here's another best friend who has just died, or here's another will from another uncle to another mansion. It doesn't work for me. So that meant that I had to create my own props, and I've never been very satisfied with my physical creativity. I've learned to feel pretty confident about my creativity in other regards, but making a handout, it always feels flat to me. So what I eventually started doing was I decreased the number of physical props that I use and instead would improvise in the moment. So they find a journal entry. And all those handouts are always a compressed version of it. Like, no one gives you, unless you're really, really lucky and have a really, really deluxe crew, no one hands you a full diary of full pages of madness for you to sort through. And then, you know, you end up getting, you know, Cliff's Notes versions of whatever this stuff is. So I would improvise that on the spot. Put myself on the spot to do that. And it's a direct connection with the player. I'm talking directly to them about what it is that they're getting from this particular clue. And then I would create a kind of as inspiring a handout as I could after the fact, because I felt like I get more impact from the delivery of it than I would by handing over a piece of paper with dot matrix text on it or whatever. And then now with this particular campaign, I'm doing the same. I find I'm doing the same thing, except now I get to get the exact text of what I improvised in the moment from what I know about the thing that they're reading, and then can make that into the exact handout, and then it flashes up on the screen and it's there forever. And
yeah, I'd never considered the idea of giving the handout after. Like, that makes so much more sense, and then, you know, the players have that thing that they can, you know, look at and touch and stuff. So
one thing that I ran across as a problem in the old days was you find this thing in the desk drawer, and let's say it's supposed to be a file folder full of different papers, like therapist notes. And so you hand it to them because they've found it and they go, wow. But then they stop everything. They start to read it.
Yeah.
Is that really what your character is doing in this moment? Or are you going to, you know, stuff this thing in your suit coat and beat a hasty retreat and go read this in a safe place?
That's actually a really good point.
Things which end up breaking the moment, I shy away from. So, you know, if they tell me I stop and read it right now, then, you know, sure, no problem.
I really like that idea. Like, and I think that keeps it more realistic. And I do think that it, because it does put a damper on the game, right? When you're in the middle and then all of a sudden everybody stops engaging, and then this sort of mood that you've created is kind of wrecked. And, you know, trying to move forward from that point is a little difficult.
Start again.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, that's actually a really great tip. This has been a really great conversation. I feel like we could be talking about this for a really long time, and I definitely would love to talk to you again on Call of Cthulhu and how you do this, because I feel like there's, especially talking about NPCs and all this kind of stuff and your, how you've approached your scenario design. I think these are all really, really great sort of, I guess maybe like expert topics to like delve into, but as an introduction, I feel like this has been, I've learned a lot just listening to you and how you approach things.
Thanks.
What I wanted to kind of finish on was, so like the show is really about helping GMs run a better game. And I was wondering, do you have any sort of advice beyond all the really great things that you've talked about so far that you could offer to a new or a veteran GM, you know, one or the other or both at the same time, you know, that might help them out and make them better?
My core principles, like I said before, are talk with the players, play the right game, and be part of the solution. And what that hides is that if you're new and you haven't played this game before, haven't run this game before, it might look like the right game and might not be. It might be one house rule or one tweak away from being the right game, or it might mean that it shows you what you do or don't like about this particular type of game. But it's one step along the process. So there may be a lot of unsatisfying nights. And that's like any other thing that you undertake. We don't, you know, pick up a tennis racket and go out on the court and be awesome. There's a painful learning process, or, you know, whatever sport or, you know, language learning or cooking endeavor you might want to pursue. There's a trial and error process. But what's cool about role playing is that you've got the group. And if you enlist them as a group and rely on them as a group, where we're all responsible for the group as a whole having a good experience, well, you know, that's a very supportive place to be. And it's the best place to make mistakes. And it's the best place to get support for when you stop making them and things really start to fly. So that would be my advice.
I feel like that's solid advice. Did you have anything that you wanted to plug before we go?
No, nothing is, I'm hip deep in editing a monumental project right now, which will be out later in the year. And I can't talk about it just yet. So there'll be more scenarios or more sessions of the Call of Cthulhu campaign in our future, and the conversation about conversation being the medium of RPGs and what that really means, they'll continue to come out as well. So business as usual, I guess.
I love it. And just tell us where we can find you. I'm going to have it in the show notes, but for those who just have audio.
Right. The written blog, all one word, is castingshadowsblog.com. The YouTube channel is YouTube. You can find me at Runeslinger. And the podcast also, you can find me at Runeslinger for Spotify podcast and wherever else, you know, you find your podcast episodes.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you so much, Anthony. This has been a fantastic conversation. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
My pleasure.
I feel like I've learned a lot in this little conversation. Like I definitely want to continue talking to you, like I said, because this has been such a fascinating approach. I feel like you have so much experience that I could really benefit from. So thanks again for coming on the show.
My pleasure. I'm looking forward to hearing about your run of Mass, because I think that will be a pretty fantastic teacher all on its own. There's a lot of tremendous support that they baked into that new version, and I think you got a lot of fun ahead of you.
Thanks. I'm not going to lie. I'm pretty scared, but I'm going to do my best. And I'm definitely going to talk about it, because I think that, you know, as a talking about our experiences is one way to help other people grow in this hobby. So
truth.
Right. All right. Well, thank you very much again. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and
that's all for this week, folks. Music and stingers by Reed Reimer of Fable Factory Studio. Cover art by John McNally. And a special thanks to Edward Vallee, the voice of Hector.
Greetings, listener. This is I, Hector, the real Dungeon Plunger. Not that milk drinker Jason. We in the dungeon always appreciate whatever love you can give us. So please, share the podcast, send your messages, and do anything that will unclog our algorithm. We really appreciate it. Plungers up!
And remember, when you're plunging in the dungeon and nature calls, watch out for mimics disguised as toilets. They're a pain in the butt.